This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. And you know, you can listen to The Takeaway anytime by subscribing to our podcast. You can find that on our website, thetakeaway.org, or on iTunes.
It's Friday. Let's take a look at a tally of the week's winners and losers.
This is unprecedented government intrusion into the private sector.
The Cambridge police acted stupidly.
There is no place to go for North Korea. They have no friends left.
Alexei! Yes! 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 Yes!
Whoa, yes! What a week! Who's up, who's down, and who'd like to take a mulligan and do the week over? It's The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning. It's Friday, July 24th. I'm Catherine Lanfer here with Farai Chidea. We're filling in for John Hockenberry today. Good morning, Farai.
Hey, it is always great to be with you.
On The Takeaway this hour, the minimum wage goes up. That's either a good or a bad thing, depending on whom you ask. And we'll bring you both takes. Plus, the funniest place on earth this week. Comics from around the world are headed to a humor festival. We're going to tag along. But first, let's bring in Marcus Mabry. He's the New York Times International Business Editor and our own personal hero here at The Takeaway. All right, Marcus, biggest winners and losers of the week?
Well, winners is easy. Mark Burley, they call it a perfect game for a reason. He's the big winner.
Yes, yes, yes.
Biggest loser, unfortunately, I have to say right now, America. This could change, but right now so far, whether you're talking about health care or race, the debates we've had this week on those two issues have brought a lot more fire than light.
And we're going to have more about that in just a moment, but first, everything you need to know this morning, Farai.
Well, in the headlines, the Senate bill on health care is on hold. The top Senate Democrat says there won't be a vote before the August recess. The president wanted lawmakers to pass it before leaving. Now President Obama says he wants to sign health care changes into law by the end of the year. This afternoon, the president gives a speech on education. Then tonight, he'll be backing a UN treaty on rights for the disabled. And today is the 19th anniversary of the Americans with Disabilities Act.
As we mentioned, minimum wage workers get a boost today. The federal minimum hourly rate is now $7.25. That's a 70-cent rise. An estimated 4.5 million Americans work for minimum wage. Two American troops are dead after a bomb attack in southern Afghanistan. There's a stepped-up American offensive in that region.
Treasury Secretary Tim Geithner and Fed Chair Ben Bernanke are both on the Hill for dueling testimony this morning. They're in a public debate over who should have the final word in consumer protection.
Voting has begun on California's budget. Lawmakers need to close a $26 billion gap. The budget deal could pass in full as early as this morning. Farai, tell us about the markets.
Yes, Wall Street gained more than 2% yesterday. Yay, 401k! The Dow starts trading at 9069. That's the first day above 9,000 since January. The S&P begins at 976. NASDAQ kicks off at 1973. And, you know, this week, have there been debates or debates, Catherine?
There have been winners and losers. And besides your 401k, we'd
exactly.
like to know what you think they are.
Yeah. President Obama on health care, winner or loser? You know, we want to ask, what do you think? What's the big story and what's the takeaway? 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org. Give us a ring.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at knightfoundation.org.
You're listening to The Takeaway.
It's Friday, and we're going to take a look back at the week, do a little tally, the winners and the losers. And maybe those people who'd like to do the week over. We have President Obama selling his embattled health care plan, Secretary of State Clinton taking aim at North Korea, and a Harvard professor and PBS star facing down police from inside his own home. Here to help us with this week's tally, our friends Marcus Mabry, international business editor at the New York Times, and Raihan Salam. He's a fellow at the New America Foundation and co-author of Grand New Party, how Republicans can win the working class and save the American dream. Gentlemen, thanks for joining us. Marcus, we're going to start with you. Let's start with health care. This week, you couldn't have turned on the television set without seeing President Obama making his pitch.
The cost of our health care has weighed down our economy and our conscience long enough.
Inaction is no longer an option. The choice to defer reform is nothing more than a decision to defend the status quo, and I will not defend the status quo. We are going to change health care reform.
Wow, that's so stirring. And then, of course, the other noise that we heard about the health care debate was Harry Reid saying, not going to happen before the recess. So where does that leave us?
Well, it's not over yet. It's interesting that the change in tone of the president between the beginning of the week and the end of the week,
is quite stark.
Absolutely. At the beginning, you're saying, well, you know, damn the torpedoes, full speed ahead. And now we have him saying, well, you know, it's worth waiting if we can get a consensus bill. And that's the way he originally, of course, launched his politics, was about consensus. But he said this was such an important reform, it must happen quickly. It's not over by far. Harry Reid also told the White House that they're going to come back and they will have a bipartisan from the Senate Finance Committee bill proposal, the first bipartisan proposal we've seen, but before they actually adjourn on August 8th. That's what Harry Reid said. That's a positive if it is true.
Okay, Raihan, do you see a clear winner or loser this week?
That is a very hard question to answer. I think that President Obama is scrambling. So in that sense, I think he's a loser. But I don't think that, again, as Marcus pointed out, I don't think the fight is over. So he may have lost this week. He may have lost the battle, but he certainly hasn't lost the war. I think that he's done an incredibly good job of expressing the idea of urgency, of the need for healthcare reform. And he's dazzlingly articulate in describing exactly what's gone wrong. At the same time, I don't think that the public connects his solutions to what he describes as the crisis itself. And I think that's a big problem.
I know that he has said he'd rather focus on policy than politics. But if you're looking at this in a purely political framework, it's a loss this week for the president. Ryan? Marcus, go ahead.
Yeah, I think that's definitely true.
And Marcus?
It's definitely excellent for the Republicans. Right now, the Republicans don't have to do anything other than kind of let the train wreck happen as the Democrats negotiate with the Democrats.
The other story that dominated the news this week, of course, was the arrest of African-American scholar Henry Louis Gates outside his home in Cambridge. Yesterday, the Cambridge police held a press conference to defend themselves after President Obama said that the police had acted stupidly.
I believe that Sergeant Crowley acted in a way that is consistent with his training at the department and consistent with national standards of law enforcement protocol. I do not believe his actions in any way were racially motivated.
How much did the presidential commentary give further life to the story? We're still talking about race. We're having this stimulating race conversation. So I'm wondering, given the work that he's done, does this mean that in the end, Professor Gates is a winner? Marcus?
Well, it's not how you look at it.
There's a construction for you, huh?
Yeah, you know, I think Skip Gates himself would have a hard time seeing himself as a winner because as he and the Cambridge police originally said when the Cambridge police dropped the charges against him, judging these charges themselves of disorderly conduct and disturbing the peace as unwarranted, they also issued a statement jointly with him saying it was an unfortunate and regrettable incident. That's what they said on Tuesday. Now we've gotten to the point where it's true because of the president's remark. It's kind of given new life to the issue. But Skip Gates wasn't going to let it go in the first place because he said he wanted to use this issue that someone as famous as him, as little as him, who's been, you know, now kind of portrayed as this threat. And he's a little guy, 5'7" or so, probably 150 pounds, soaking wet. And you know, the kind of quintessential archetype of a professor could be used as or seen as a kind of a threat by a police officer and arrested in his own home. Look, every African-American male, and I'm an African-American male, this is something we live with every day, a fear. I've been stopped with my partner, who's a white male, by police just kind of in regular traffic stops and stuff. And I'm the one always saying, you know, sir, yes, sir, yes, sir, yes, sir, and being incredibly deferential because the fear is they have the power, and it's usually a white policeman. And if they want to do something untoward, if you offend them, and that's what Skip Gates did, by accusing him of racism, Skip Gates offended this officer. This officer used his power then to arrest Skip Gates.
Yeah, and this is for Rai today. Raihan, again, you know, Raihan Salam, fellow at New America Foundation. there is now the whole police record is public, and Skip Gates did say to the officers, basically the phrase he used, "Why? Because I'm a black man in America." That was his sort of punch kicker line when, you know, he was saying, "I don't want to leave my home in handcuffs." Isn't that a fair thing to say? I mean, should that get you arrested, you know, does that make you a provocateur? What do you think?
Well, absolutely not. I think that in itself, but I think at the same time, the dynamics of these situations are always incredibly difficult. I mean, the job of a police officer is just one where you're confronted with all kinds of dilemmas constantly. You're interpreting information that's coming at you very quickly, and sometimes it's hard to decide exactly what you're going to do. My gut instinct is that Skip Gates has every right to be really upset, and I think, you know, when watching the president's statement, it's hard not to empathize with it. I think it makes a lot of sense. It's how a lot of us feel about encounters with the police. At the same time, I also think that, you know, as the president, Obama has done an excellent job of trying to get himself out of the fray and give a more kind of global bird's eye view of a situation. That's one of his great talents. And that's why I was surprised. And a lot of people have talked about how, you know, he was a little tired, or it was a very gut level, very sincere response. But it's a situation where, you know, for example, when he was talking about Iran and the protesters there, he didn't give his gut level sincere response because he recognized that as president, you have to exercise some caution and you have to step back and speak on behalf of the country.
You know, there was another conversation that's been going on that has been some fiery give and take, and that's Hillary Clinton on her trip to Asia. Let's listen to what she had to say about North Korea.
Well, what we've seen is this constant demand for attention. And maybe it's the mother in me or the experience that I've had with small children and unruly teenagers and people who are demanding attention. Don't give it to them. They don't deserve it.
Okay. Now, is that the Secretary of State flexing her muscle? Are we going to have any real outcome from this particular exchange? We should point out, of course, that North Korea then went on to lobby some remarks back at her.
Criticize the Sisterhood of the Traveling Pantsuit.
Something like that. Ryan, let's go to you.
I thought it was dazzling. I thought it was fantastic. I think that she is incredibly tart, and I think that North Korea deserved it. And I think that, you know, the worry is, oh, you know, these guys need to be handled very gingerly. Oh, you know, they let's not ruffle their feathers. And I think that, you know, she said what is on everyone's mind. And I think that, you know, at a certain level, they don't deserve to be taken seriously. Yes, they have, you know, they're brimming with weapons, and there's a tremendous amount of uncertainty. But I also think that she should hardly be blamed for the fact that they're, you know, unstable lunatics. And I thought that it was fantastic, so I applaud her for it.
Marcus?
I think she was trying to underline the fact that there's a consensus now that was never there before, including on the part of the Chinese, North Korea's closest allies, if they have any allies at all at this point. She was saying they have no allies left, no friends. But the important part of it, I think, is that she also really expressed a hard line saying we're not going to go back to just negotiations for the sake of negotiations. And that's something that, ironically, the Obama administration is now looking as hawkish as the Bush administration was when it first came in. Because at the end of the Bush administration, they were actually negotiating. There was a framework set up of talks, six-party talks, that didn't lead to – it led to an agreement the North Koreans then backed out on. So it's interesting that in this respect, the Obama administration is actually tougher and more hawkish than their Republican predecessors.
And Marcus, we should mention the Henry Louis Gates Jr. story continuing to develop now. Sergeant Crowley, the arresting officer, will be holding a press conference at noon. And the attorney for Professor Gates, Charles Ogletree, is telling CNN, to paraphrase it, that he is displeased with the way that Professor Gates is being portrayed by Cambridge police, and he's prepared to bring forward other witnesses who have had similar experiences with Sergeant Crowley in the past. I want to thank both of you for stopping by. Marcus Mabry, New York Times International Business Editor, and Raihan Salam, the New America Foundation.
And we'll have something a little bit lighter coming up. The Just for Laughs Festival is this week in Montreal. We'll check in with two comedians about what makes it important to watch. Next up on The Takeaway.
You
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MYTAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual, dedicated to helping safeguard businesses and employees through comprehensive insurance products and services. More information at libertymutualgroup.com. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
I'm Farai Chidea here with Catherine Lamfer. We are sitting in for John Hockenberry. And the funniest city in the world this weekend is going to be Montreal, Canada. That is where the annual Just for Laughs Festival is held. This is the 27th year. This year's festival started just yesterday. It runs through Sunday. And as usual, a swarm of comedians from around the world are going to descend on the city for shows, hundreds of shows. Joining us, we've got Steve Heisler, contributor to The Onion's AV Club, and Andy Kindler. Andy's a writer and comedian and a veteran of the festival. They are both in Montreal. Hi, guys.
Hello.
Hello.
Hello to you.
So, Steve, let me start with you. This is a big deal in the comedy world. Can you just explain a little bit of, you know, what it's like?
Well, there's a wide variety of shows. There's these really big shows that happen. There's smaller shows, more intimate shows. The Just for Laughs people go out and they scout these comedians that a lot of people don't know. So if you're one of those young comedians, this is the place to go to be discovered by the industry, to get that kind of exposure. And also just to, like, celebrate stand-up comedy, to celebrate sketch and improv as well.
Okay. So you've got some big names coming in, like Bill Cosby, Judd Apatow. This festival is also a place where lots of young comedians come to play for, you know, these huge audiences. So if you had your choice, Steve, would you go to a Bill Cosby show or, like, a more underground show?
Well, I see a lot of comedy, so to me, something that's new and exciting is what's going to draw me. So, I mean, at least I know in Just for Laughs, they have people whose job it is full-time to go out and discover these people that haven't really had a lot of industry exposure. So I want to see the fruits of that labor, essentially.
All right, Andy, you know, you're a veteran of the festival. You have this very specific prominent role at Just for Laughs, which is to deliver an annual State of the Industry speech. What the heck is that?
Well, I like to call it, it's Judgment Day, is what I like to call it. What I do is every year I come to Montreal, and I before I get here, I try to build up some momentum in my career. And then I come here and say horrible things about all the people who could potentially employ me at some future point, who will not employ me because I say negative things about them.
Well, you know, there are some people who we have identified as being in your rifle sights. Here's one of them.
Millions of citizens in India are preparing for tomorrow's rare solar eclipse. Many people believe that it means that demons will appear and swallow the sun. That's all anyone in India are talking about, so making tomorrow the worst possible day to need tech support. That's just going to be terrible. If you've got problems with your printer, you better wait till Friday. I mean, it's just not worth it.
All right, that's Jimmy Fallon, who has inherited an incredibly sweet spot on TV. What do you think about him?
Well, the thing is that I love the first night that he did his show where he kind of basically said, "Hi, it's Jimmy Fallon. It's my new show. What else is in the news?" I don't really – like, I didn't even recognize that that was his voice when you put him on there. I mean, I think he is extremely handsome, and nobody can argue against the fact
– he's got good hair.
He is a very – he's – yeah, he has good TVQ. He looks great in a suit. But I don't understand whatever screamed out in Jimmy Fallon's career talk show host. And also Jimmy looks like he's sometimes drowning a little bit. But, I mean, I would, too, if I was first hosting the show. But I don't know. I don't get it.
All right. Couple more people. I understand that you have been looking at Jay Leno and Ryan Seacrest.
Jay Leno. I'm wondering, can Jay Leno be as – will he be able to be as edgy at 10 p.m. as he was at 11:35? I mean, will he have to – will he still be able to keep that jazzy late-night feel that he has? I hope he won't have to dumb down his act even further. And, you know, he was touring the country. He was giving free comedy stimulus shows a couple of months ago.
Mm-hmm.
Haven't people suffered enough? How is that going to help? Jay Leno's coming to town. Does he have any money for my rent?
Ryan Seacrest just got a $45 million deal. How's his hair? Is it his hair that's really making
him
that money?
Well, where is the outrage over that? Forget the CEOs of these large companies and AIG and the auto companies. Is anyone looking into the fact that Ryan Seacrest is making $45 million?
Well, you know, I'm going to go back to you, Steve. How dangerous is it to skewer people in your business? Do they retaliate?
Well, I mean, it's the comedy business. You would hope that they would have a sense of humor about it.
They don't.
Yeah, they don't.
Everyone's very thin-skinned. Not me, though. You can say anything you want about me.
So when you go out and give this State of the Industry address, what do people say to you afterwards, Andy Kindler, or do they just avoid you?
No, people seem to like it because they seem – well, the people who are there. I've never been – I've never made fun of someone for a long – like Leno doesn't come to the speech. Oh, I haven't seen him there. Maybe he comes in disguise. But people who are there – everyone who's there are all industry people and comedians. And so they kind of – their feeling is for that hour they can listen to me and enjoy it and then go back to ruining everything afterwards.
All right. Well, then – that brings me to my final question for each of you. I'm going to go to Steve first. Define funny for me in one sentence.
Unexpected.
One word. Wow, that's great.
That's my sentence.
Yeah, I love it. Andy Kindler?
Paul Blart Mall Cop. You didn't see that, did you?
I didn't see
Paul Blart.
I guess I was spared.
It's Kevin James as a mall cop, and he's in the mall, and at one point he holds on to someone's motorized wheelchair, and they drag him across the floor, and many people would define that as comedy, and to me, that's depressing.
My question for Andy is, you saw this movie?
No. That's the other thing. Most of the things I criticize, I don't see because I don't want that to affect my opinion.
Okay, that's one way to do it. Andy Kindler, comedian. He's going to be delivering the State of the Industry speech at the Just for Laughs Festival, and also Steve Heisler, contributor to the Onion's AV Club. Thanks, guys, and now we have Femi, okay, with the headlines.
Thank you very much indeed. 28 minutes past the hour. Good morning, all. Healthcare on the Hill is a no-go before Congress breaks up in August. Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid says that the president will have to wait for Congress to pass thoughtful legislation instead of jamming something through quickly. The debate over President Obama's comments about the arrest of Harvard scholar Henry Louis Gates Jr. is still bubbling. Cambridge Police Sergeant James Crowley told WBZAM he doesn't agree with the president's comments that his department acted stupidly.
I support the president of the United States 110%. I think he's way off base wading into a local issue without knowing all the facts, as he himself stated before he made that comment.
The White House press secretary, Robert Gibbs, says the president wasn't calling the officer who made the arrest stupid, just commenting that the situation got out of hand. In Alaska, the state will be bidding farewell to Governor Sarah Palin this weekend. Her last day in office is Sunday, but she gets plenty on her plate coming up in the next few months, including a book deal. And finally, around about 4.5 million people get a boost today as the federal minimum wage goes up 70 cents to $7.25 an hour. The hike will raise the rates in 30 states. In the other states, wages are already above the federal minimum. That is a look at top stories making news this morning.
All right. Thanks,
Femi.
Thank
you.
You're welcome.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable development in communities across the country. More at rockfound.org.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual, dedicated to celebrating personal responsibility and to proving its own with a comprehensive array of auto insurance products. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility, what's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway.
I'm Catherine Lanfer here with Fareg Daya. We're both in for John Hockenberry. Here's the good news on the economy. The Dow had a blowout day yesterday, posting its highest closing since last November, topping the 9,000 mark for the first time since January. Now, if you're not on Wall Street but Main Street, there's another uptick you might be interested in. The minimum wage goes up today from $6.55 to $7.25. And to check in about all of this, we're going to go to economist and business professor at the University of Maryland, Peter Morici, our own personal finance guru here. All right, Professor, what can we take from the Dow's closing yesterday? Can we start to be optimistic?
I think we should start to be optimistic. Overall, we've seen more and more, you know, green shoots, as we call them these days, that the economy is starting to turn around. And I expect job losses to end by the end of the year, and that the economy will start to take off in the fourth quarter. And the market tends to smell that stuff in advance because the analysts are looking at the sales prospects of the companies, not how they did last quarter, but how they're going to do next quarter. And the assessment's positive. Also, remember, the Dow is still down 36% from its 2007 high, so these are hardly high prices.
What is behind the rise?
Well, we've had very good profitability reports for the second quarter, which reflects the fact that during this recession, people have really downsized their businesses and adjusted to an economy where there's more saving. So now they can essentially make profits at lower volumes. The whole GM restructuring was about that, but it was going on all around the country.
Let's go to the other uptick, and that is, of course, the rise in the minimum wage. Talk about what impact you think that's going to have on the economy and on jobs.
Well, it has a very mixed impact. For the people that keep their jobs, that make minimum wage or just above, they get a pay increase and they spend more money. Those folks will spend the money because they don't have a lot to save. But some folks with those jobs are going to lose them. And some folks are not going to get hired. And it's going to be very magnified in poorer parts of the country, you know, northern Maine, rural Mississippi, the Dakotas, places where there's not a robust job market, and their times are never really great. So it's a mixed blessing for the poor. This minimum wage increase is terribly timed, given where we are in the economy. But it was statute.
Well, Peter, this is Farai. We've chatted before. You know, just give us a little taste of who you think will really benefit the most. You know, is it single moms? Is it, you know, just a little
actually,
taste?
You hit it. Single moms. If you go out into rural areas where the economy is never strong, you see the indigenous population working at McDonald's as a career. You see 35-year-old, 45-year-old women working behind counters, and they maybe get a dollar or two more than minimum wage because they have seniority. And whenever the minimum wage goes up, the boss bumps them up as well. It's kind of tradition, custom, if you will. Those people, this is godsend for them because, you know, they're having such a tough time. And,
right.
And this extra money, they're going to keep it. They're not going to lose their jobs. It's the people at the margin, the teenage worker or the new entrant into that class that doesn't get the job.
Right. Well, Peter, thank you so much. Again, Peter Morici, economist and business professor at the University of Maryland. You know, now I want to bring Jason DeParle into the conversation. He's a reporter for our partner, The New York Times, one of the great chroniclers, Jason is, of the working poor. You know, Peter was just saying, Jason, that raising the minimum wage actually could hurt people because it might cause a rise in unemployment. You know, do you believe that? What do you think?
On the margins, sure. Somewhere out there, somebody who might otherwise have gotten a job won't get one if the minimum wage goes up, but that's always the case.
How do you put the two scales together? You know, we're familiar with the image of the scales of justice. If you had to have the scales of, you know, losses in jobs versus the scales of, you know, the rise in pay for poor people.
By historical standards, the minimum wage is still lower than it's usually been over the last 50 years. So given all the problems we have in the economy, I don't think I'd start with the minimum wage.
Well, tell us the story. You reported on a janitor in San Francisco whose wife was pregnant. Tell us the rest of the story.
Well, with record numbers of people unemployed in the country right now, it's not a record unemployment rate, not as a percentage of the workforce, but in terms of sheer record numbers of people, there are more people unemployed now than there have ever been in the United States, and that's putting a huge strain on the unemployment insurance program. which was hobbled even before the recession began. It wasn't processing checks quickly enough, and it didn't have enough money in reserves. So the story about the man in San Francisco is he lost his job in January, and it took him until June, 6 months, to get the benefits for which he was entitled. In the meantime, his wife was pregnant with their first child. And for people who are living one paycheck at a time, a delay of even a week or two can make the difference between a missed meal or a missed rent payment. He went 6 months, and his pregnant wife wound up skipping meals.
Let's talk about how this is happening across the country. We have this big squeeze on states giving out unemployment benefits. When do we hit the full button, as it were?
I'm sorry, the which button?
Well, what I mean is there's not the full button, but the money's going to be gone. I mean, the benefits are going to be tapped out.
Well, they already are in 16 states. The states, over the past decade, the taxes that states assess to finance unemployment benefits have hit their lowest record in the history of the program. And it's a steep drop-off from historical standards. If you were looking at a graph of, well, for the previous 40 years or so, unemployment taxes were about 1.1% of the average company's payroll. And over the last decade, they fell from about 40% from that level. So the funds, the reserves that states had going into this were about half what the federal government recommends. So they went in a week in the state. This happened on the theory that, you know, recessions didn't really happen anymore. They were infrequent. They were mild. We didn't need to put away money for a rainy day because it wasn't going to rain. And then the storm came.
Well, you know, just quickly, Jason, when you take a look at states like California, you know, which has one of the highest rates of, you know, this kind of IOU system, you know, where they just don't have any money. Do you think that there will be some kind of massive federal spending over a long period of time to pay unemployment, or that
just through the end of next year, California is expected to borrow $18 billion? I mean, $18 billion. That used to be half of what the program spent a year. I mean, that's a lot of money even in today's standards. And they're going to have to pay that money back to the federal government, and interest is going to start kicking in at the end of next year as well. So what that portends is two things: higher taxes on businesses, just at a time when businesses are trying to come out of the recession, go into recovery. That's going to hurt businesses. It's going to slow job creation. And then the other half of it is going to be cuts in benefits, which could be either cuts in the amount of benefits or cuts in the number of people who can get benefits. And that's going to hurt workers at a time when they can't afford it either. So it's terrible timing.
Well, Jason, thank you so much. Again, Jason DeParle, reporter for The New York Times.
Now, in just about 10 minutes, we're going to be talking about the legacy of Alaska Governor Sarah Palin. She's going to be leaving office soon. Now, what about the book she's going to be writing? It's all still ahead on The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Farai Chidea.
And I'm Catherine Lanfer.
Alexei! Yes! 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 Yes!
That is what it sounded like in Chicago last night when White Sox pitcher Mark Burley executed one of the rarest feats in baseball, a perfect game. It was versus the Tampa Bay Devil Rays. Our friend Dave Zirin was watching. He writes about sports for The Nation magazine, and his book is A People's History of Sports in the United States. All right, Dave. This is a huge weekend for baseball. Hall of Fame inclusion, at ceremony at Cooperstown, the voting. We're going to go on about that for a minute. But first, okay, Mark Burley, 27 batters up, 27 batters down. How was it for you?
It's huge. It was huge. I mean, in a summer of sports scandal and death and depression, I mean, it was a reminder of why we love sports so much. I mean, the last time a Chicago pitcher threw a perfect game, Warren G. Harding was president. 77 years ago.
Tell me, were you dancing around the television going, yes, yes,
well,
yes?
Well, I mean, I kept thinking that, I mean, I started hearing about it actually on the internet. I mean, it's like Mark Burley has a perfect game through five innings. And I was like, yeah, whatever. Been there, done that, seen that.
Jaded thing.
Because you think, you know, you get cynical about this. Mm-hmm. But then it's like six innings, seven innings, eight innings. And it's like, holy word, I can't say on the radio, this is actually going to happen. And it was made all the more amazing by two quick things that I'd love to say. Three
yes.
quick things.
Hurry.
The first is that Tampa Bay, third best hitting team in Major League Baseball. Hardly a cream puff. Second thing is that Mark Burley is not a Nolan Ryan type pitcher. He's not a flamethrower. He throws the ball so other teams hit it poorly. And that usually leads to what's called a ground ball with eyes. You know, a hit that's weak. And yet that didn't happen. 27 up, 27 down. And then lastly, in the ninth inning, you have the play of my lifetime, where a defensive replacement named Dwayne Wise climbs the fence and robs Gabe Kapler of a home run to save not just the perfect game, but the shutout. It was amazing.
Hey, Dave, let's talk about some other plays of some other lifetimes. Jim Rice, going to be inducted into the Baseball Hall of Fame. Give me the 10-second primer on why this is such a great story.
It's a great story because Jim Rice deserves to be there. Supreme Court Justice once said, I can't define pornography, but I know it when I see it. When I saw Jim Rice play, that's a Hall of Famer, no matter what the statistics say.
10 years to get elected to the Hall? What happened?
Jim Rice and reporters, they go together like Dick Cheney and the Sierra Club. They are not friends. And yet there is Jim Rice. He deserves it. I'm so glad he's going to be there. There was a lot of anger towards him among the chattering classes. He overcame it through his greatness.
Mark McGwire fell short this year, as he has in past years. In fact, he got fewer votes this year. So talk to me about what that means about those allegations of steroids use and what they're going to mean for the Hall of Fame.
Yeah, Mark McGwire has never failed a steroid test, but as long as the accusations swirl around him, he will never get in the Hall of Fame. That goes to other players as well, like Sammy Sosa and Rafael Palmeiro. They will exact extreme justice against people who even have the whiff of steroid accusations against them for decades to come.
Now, tell me that Mark Burley, we're not going to find out that he was using something when he did this perfect game. Tell me that's not going to happen.
No, because the guy can't break a pane glass window with his fastball. So there's no way he's on steroids.
All right. Thank you, Dave. Always good to talk to you.
Thank you.
That is Dave Zirin, writes about sports for The Nation.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, examining whether states have the right to legislate the foods and restaurants that people choose. Is it a responsible way to make communities healthier, or does it violate freedom of choice? Viewpoints now at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
I'm Farayat Shadeya here with Catherine Lanford in for John Hockenberry, and we have Femi Oke with the headlines.
Thank you very much. The time is almost 12 minutes to the top of the hour. The Senate is putting President Obama's health care plan on hold for now. The top Senate Democrat says there will not be a vote on a health bill until the August recess. The president says that he can live without the Senate missing the deadline. He says he can live with the Senate missing the deadline, but he doesn't want the delay to drag out.
My attitude is I want to get it right, but I also want to get it done promptly.
The president now says that he wants to sign healthcare changes into law by the end of the year. Minimum wage workers are getting a pay raise today. The federal minimum hourly rate is now $7.25. That's a 70-cent rise. An estimated 4.5 million Americans work for the minimum wage. Treasury Secretary Tim Geithner and Fed Chair Ben Bernanke are both on the Hill for dueling testimony this morning. They're in a public debate over who should have the final word in consumer protection. Fresh details are coming out about a massive corruption probe centered in New Jersey. The feds say that the investigation is uncovering everything from laundered millions to black market kidney sales. More than 40 people are under arrest, including mayors, lawmakers and rabbis. It is one of the biggest corruption investigations in the region's history. Looking overseas, while the Iraqi Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki has been in the United States on a diplomatic tour, Angelina Jolie has been in Iraq's northwest visiting displaced people. Have a listen to the reception she received when she arrived in a suburb of Baghdad yesterday.
Miss Angelina Jolie!
I think they were happy to see her. Jolie was visiting a makeshift camp for displaced Iraqis as a UN Goodwill Ambassador. She took the opportunity to appeal for aid for around about 1.6 million civilians who have been displaced due to the Iraq war. So in Asia, pro-democracy leader Aung San Suu Kyi is back on trial in Myanmar, also known as Burma. Lawyers are now making their closing arguments. She's accused of violating her house arrest, and the military regime there has kept her in and out of jail for years. That's a look at big stories making news this morning.
Thank you so much, Femi. And we move on. This Sunday, Alaska's point guard is passing the ball.
A good point guard, here's what she does. She drives through a full court press, protecting the ball, keeping her head up because she needs to keep her eye on the basket. And she knows exactly when to pass the ball so that the team can win. And that is what I'm doing, keeping our eye on the ball.
Okay, that was Alaska Governor Sarah Palin on July 3rd trying to explain the reasons for her resignation. It was a really different scene from the one last summer at the Republican National Convention.
I will be honored to accept your nomination for Vice President of the United States.
And the cheers go on and on and on, or they did at that time. Palin has since gone from the apple of the Republican Party's eye to, you know, who knows. So on Sunday, Palin hands the keys to the governor's mansion to her lieutenant, Sean Parnell. So what's next? What will Governor Palin's legacy be? We have a couple of folks to help answer that. Libby Casey is a reporter for Alaska Public Radio Network. And here in studio, Bernadette Malone, former editor at Sentinel, an imprint of Penguin Publishers. Welcome to both of you. And Libby, let me start with you. Where does Sarah Palin stand in the history of Alaskan governors?
It's early to say. Remember, she's only been a governor for 2.5 years, and she's leaving her term 18 months early. And when people look back, it's likely to be divided by the pre-VP run and the post-VP run, because she does have things that may add to her brief legacy, raising oil taxes in the state, working on getting a natural gas pipeline, ethics reform, which it turns out may need to be reformed because she's been the test case and it hasn't really worked out so well. But since she's been back after running for vice president, things have not gone well. There's been a lot of conflict and strife, and as we all know, she's passing the ball. She's getting out of the game. She's ejecting herself. So it's a lot of the legacy may be determined by what the lieutenant governor does and how he decides to carry on what she started.
How much relief is there for Alaskans that she is stepping down?
Well, you know, it's really, when I talk to people down here in the lower 48, I'm in Washington, D.C.
Mm-hmm. I love the lower 48,
say,
by the way.
Yeah, that's what we call it. Republicans say, good for her. You know, this is the strong base. Good for her. Way to make a tough stand. Alaskans do not feel that way. By and large, they're still flummoxed by the fact that she's made this decision, and by and large, very disappointed. But there is a sense of relief because the lieutenant governor, Sean Parnell, is seen as being a no-drama kind of guy. And the biggest change is going to be the personality. He's keeping a lot of cabinet and other key staff. And it's interesting that when I talk to staffers, they're staying, and they say the reason why is because they feel like they owe it to the people of Alaska to stay at their post. Very different than what Sarah Palin is doing. So I think Alaskans are, by and large, ready to turn a new chapter and move forward.
Well, speaking of turning a new chapter, it's a perfect metaphor because, you know, Bernadette Malone, you are a former editor at Sentinel, an imprint of Penguin Publishers, and what she is definitely going to be doing is creating some pages to turn. She's going to be doing a book. Tell us a little bit about that project.
Well, she has a memoir, autobiography, coming out in time for Mother's Day 2010. She has a co-writer, which is not at all unusual when a politician writes a book. And the advance for the book is reportedly very handsome. I've seen figures ranging from $7 million to $11 million. So obviously her publisher is convinced that she's still the apple of the Republican Party's eye.
I understand the book is going to be sold pretty much in two versions, one marketed to, you know, what you call mainstream audiences, another specifically targeted at Christian audiences. How will that help sales?
Well, that will help sales because the Christian audience is much bigger than many people in the mainstream understand. Remember when everybody was blindsided by the success of Mel Gibson's movie The Passion? Christian Americans buy books, they go to movies, and New York Publishing isn't always on top of that. In this case, I think they are. They're doing a co-deal with Harper and the Christian imprint, or subsidiary, I should say, Zondervan. And I think Sarah Palin's book may sell very well indeed.
You know, politicians aren't necessarily known. Okay, Ulysses S. Grant, I'll give you him. But after him, with the exception of Barack Obama's early book, when do they ever write a compelling book? What are we going to see on those pages?
Well, many say Barack Obama's book was compelling, so
well, the first
who knows?
One.
Right,
but after
right.
he was actually in office,
right,
let's
exactly.
get real. So she's been in office. What are we going to see? Is it going to put me to sleep or keep me up?
Depends on what her future plans are. If she's running for president, I don't expect her to say anything terribly controversial, or I don't expect her to put too much red meat in the book. If she's not running for president, and this is anyone's guess at this point, I think she could write a very candid tell-all. I think she can make it very Christian and very conservative and not have to worry about it hurting her electoral prospects.
If she was going to run for office, wouldn't she actually do that anyway, given that that's what her base is?
If she were running for office in 2012, she'd probably be coached to not do or say anything too extreme in the next couple of months.
Well, let me turn back to Libby Casey, Alaska Public Radio Network. If this is a tell-all book, what would be the key thing that she would tell Sarah Palin?
Well, we are getting a little bit of a taste of where Sarah Palin will be going next through Twitter. This is like the governor's thing. And so in 140 characters or less, she's been tweeting up a storm and talking about everything from sort of like philosophical things, you know, no rain, no rainbow, and, you know, don't whine, don't complain. She's also been talking about touring the state. She's been blasting people who are criticizing her ethics. And she also gave us a little hint of what's next. She said in a tweet recently that she will soon be sending less politically correct Twitters flying from her fingertips outside the state site. So she seems kind of chomping at the bit to get her personality out there more. And she obviously feels constrained by being in the governor's mansion. So we may get a taste of her personality more as she leaves the office. And, you know, your guest brings up a really good point. How intense and how real can she be in a book? One thing though, that Americans seem to like about Governor Palin is this down-home, I'm a real person, you betcha part of her personality. So she may be able to use that to her advantage and spin her story in a way that says, here are the challenges I've had, here are the successes. You know, we Americans love a story about somebody rising from the ashes and turning things into a good story.
Sarah Palin, definitely a good story. We're going to keep checking back on this. I want to thank you, Libby Casey, reporter for Alaska Public Radio Network, and Bernadette Malone, former editor at Sentinel, an imprint of Penguin Publishers.
Now, who were the big winners and losers of the week? Well, some of them are easy to tell. White Sox pitcher Mark Burley had one of the rarest feats in baseball, a perfect game. President Obama, busy selling his health care plan. So what does his scorecard look like this week? Marcus Mabry of the New York Times has an answer.
It's definitely excellent for the Republicans. Right now, the Republicans don't have to do anything other than kind of let the train wreck happen as the Democrats negotiate with the Democrats.
All right. Marcus has the Republicans ahead on that week's scorecard. But we want to ask you, who do you think was the big winner or loser of the week?
Good morning. Troy calling from Dakota. This week's big loser is any Comic-Con attendee who spent more than a month's salary on his costume.
Okay, he's
I know a costumer for Comic-Con. Anyway.
He's referring to the Comic-Con International taking place in San Diego this week. Batman fans, we hope you didn't go all out. You're listening to The Takeaway.
I'm Farai Chidea.
And I'm Catherine Lanford.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org, the Rockefeller Foundation and its campaign for American workers. More at rockfound.org, and by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is The Takeaway.
Healthcare reform is on the slow road, but on the fast track, a great deal starting today if you need a new car.
So bring in that old jalopy and get up to $4,500 towards the purchase of a new or select used vehicle. That's right, get up to $4,500 for that old piece of junk.
We are talking about cash for clunkers on The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning. It's Friday, July 24th. I am Farai Chidea along with Catherine Lanfer. We're filling in for John Hockenberry. Morning.
Hey, good morning, Farai.
On The Takeaway this hour, we're going to talk to President Obama's point man on green power. That's Energy Secretary and Nobel Prize winner Stephen Chu. He's joining our ongoing climate change conversation. Plus, in the hidden heap of lousy summer movies, there are hidden gems. New York Times film critic A.O. Scott is The Takeaway's cinematic diamond miner in chief. He'll be here to share his discoveries with you. But right now, we're going to go back onto the car lot. Mary Dubois in Oklahoma is taking advantage of the deal we just talked about. It's called Cash for Clunkers. Mary, what are you trading in and what are you getting back?
We're trading in a 94 Dodge Shadow and we're buying a 2009 Chevy Equinox.
And do you feel like you're getting a good deal out of this new program, you know, this rebate program?
Very much so. We got a lot more for our Dodge Shadow than it was definitely worth.
All right. We're going to find out the exact details of that shortly. But first, everything you need to know this morning, Catherine.
In the headlines, no dice, Mr. President. That's the top Senate Democrats' message to President Obama on his health care plan. No Senate vote on the bill before the August recess. The president says he can live with the delay as long as it doesn't drag out too long. He says he wants to sign health care changes into law by the end of the year. This afternoon, the president gives a speech on education. Tonight, he backs a UN treaty on rights for the disabled. Today is the 19th anniversary of the Americans with Disabilities Act.
An estimated 4.5 million minimum wage workers got a raise today. The federal minimum hourly rate is now $7.25. That is a 70-cent rise. Supporters of the hike say that it helps the economy by giving people spending money. Critics say it will hurt because businesses could cut hours and jobs. And two American troops are dead after a bomb attack today in southern Afghanistan. There's a stepped-up American offensive in that region, and July is already the deadliest month for U.S. and NATO troops.
California lawmakers trying to pass a plan to close the $26 billion budget gap there. It's been slow going so far. Voting started last night and dragged into early this morning.
All right, well, let's take a look at the markets. Wall Street gained more than 2% yesterday. The Dow starts trading at 90.69. That's the first opening above 9,000 since January. The S&P begins at 976, NASDAQ at 1973. And there have been plenty of huge debates this week.
Where do we even start?
I know. It's race relations, health care, former senator and secretary of state Hillary Clinton being criticized for her fashion sense and appearance by North Korea. So what are you tracking? What's the big story, the big winner or loser of the week? Tell us your thoughts at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org. That's right. Give us a call. The Sisterhood of the Traveling Pantsuit, thumbs up, thumbs down. What do you think?
I don't think the North Koreans can talk about fashion.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at knightfoundation.org.
You're listening to The Takeaway.
Had the TV on lately? Maybe you've heard a car ad that sounds a little something like this.
Who'd have thought? You put that old bike or sofa in a garage sale and someone buys it for $500. Hi, this is Steve Blake of Utah Brick Chevrolet, and this very same thing is happening, but with your old clunker. How about getting up to $4,500 from the U.S. government for your old car or truck?
Hey, who'd have thought? The billion-dollar federal Cash for Clunkers program officially kicks off today, allowing Americans to trade in their clunkers, that would be cars with bad gas mileage, for up to, as the man said, $4,500 toward fuel-efficient vehicles. Now, some dealerships have already begun offering their trade-ins, and we're going to go now to Oklahoma City. That's where Mary Dubois lives. She's already taken advantage of one of those deals. All right, Mary, tell us what your beloved clunker was like.
It was a 94 Dodge Shadow. The air conditioning didn't work. The driver's side window didn't go down. The paint was peeling. It was definitely a clunker.
Hey, what was not to love about this car, huh?
Well, in Oklahoma City, air conditioning's pretty important. My husband was just dying of the heat driving it.
Now, what was the speedometer on?
It was about 110,000 miles.
This sounds like the perfect car, like if you had a teenager learning how to drive or something.
We had originally bought it for our teenagers. It went through three boys learning to drive who are all grown now and long gone out of the house, so it had served its purpose.
Oh, my goodness. Clunker, we hardly knew you.
Yeah, exactly.
So did you feel sad at all about letting it go?
Not for a moment. We were happy the program came along because we probably otherwise wouldn't have gotten, you know, $100 for it.
Wow. And instead, what did you get?
We got $3,500.
All right. We're going to move now to Dan Neal. He's an auto critic for the L.A. Times. Dan, could you give us some of the specifics of how cash for clunkers works?
Sure. Well, you'll be able to go to the dealership and say, okay, with your 1996 Jeep Cherokee, for example, and a vehicle that doesn't get 18 miles per gallon. One of the thresholds is that your trade-in has to get less than 18 miles per gallon combined, and you can find that out on the government website for this. And the dealer will do the calculation and decide whether you can qualify for either a $3,500 credit or a $4,500 credit. And it's really just that easy. You don't have to have any vouchers or any kind of intermediaries. The dealer will take the credit off the price of the vehicle, and in a lot of cases, dealers are adding more incentive money so that you can really come out way ahead in this program if you're one of the lucky 250,000 or so who can take advantage of it.
Hey, what happens to the clunkers after the dealer has them? Do they go to, you know, that big clunker farm in the sky?
Sure, if you're telling your kid that they're going to the farm in the country to play with other Jeep Cherokees.
Exactly.
They get recycled. They get smashed up, and it's interesting because one of the big beefs with the program is that they're going to take working vehicles and crush them and recycle them, so they can't take, you know, engines and other kinds of parts out to sell on the secondary parts market. And that has created some agita among people.
Well, I know some critics who say that actually this isn't as environmentally correct as we might like to think. I mean, there's energy that you expend to build new cars. Maybe it's better to keep old clunkers on the road. So how do you break that one down?
It's a couple of things. You know, the car manufacturers are not going to make significantly more cars. Their production isn't going to ramp up dramatically because of this. They're just going to move them off the lots a little quicker. So it would be a very subtle effect. Second, the sunk energy costs in terms of sort of dust-to-dust and energy investment in these cars is mostly electricity. And electricity we seem to have a lot of, and these cars are built, around the world, and so that isn't so much of an issue. In terms of gasoline, that's really the critical energy source that we're trying to cut down on. And this program will do it because there are a lot of really, really inefficient cars on the road. One of the problems of making cars that last 20 years is that cars last 20 years, and the rollover rate is so slow. So those 2002 Cadillac Escalades that people were driving around, they're still driving around. They'll still be driving around a decade from now, but for programs like this.
Now, can you trade in your clunker for a foreign car as well as a domestic car?
Yep, you can. Any car qualifies as long as it gets a combined 22 miles per gallon or better. Also, category one trucks have to have, that's SUVs and trucks and vans, have to have a combined MPG of 18. That's
now
the ones you purchase.
Now, some foreign car makers are doing really well with this program. I'm thinking of Hyundai, of course. They're marketing on the fact that their name is going to get more prominent. And here's a clip from an ad featuring auto executives from around the world yelling about Hyundai.
Win one little award, and suddenly everyone gets your name right. It's Hyundai, like Sunday.
Okay, that award was the 2009 North American Car of the Year. Yesterday, Hyundai posted a record quarterly profit. So, all right, Dan, what are they doing that other car makers aren't?
Well, first of all, it would be great if the car business was that exciting.
like pitching a no-hitter?
That would be awesome. I mean, that's just what a great business it would be. No, well, what they're doing right is what everybody knows to do right. That is slow, steady progress, deep investment, strategic thinking, and from the consumer's point of view, just year after year of really, really excellent cars that overachieve for the price you pay.
You know, there is one American factory that is manufacturing only Hyundais, and it's in Montgomery, Alabama. And I'd like to go now to Rick Halstead. He is a factory worker at Hyundai there. Now, Rick, what is it exactly that you do at Hyundai?
I work in the engine shop, which produces the four cylinders for the Sonatas.
All right. And when you say you work there, what exactly do you do? Pretend that you're explaining this to your relative at the family reunion.
I work in the machining side of the engine shop where we drill holes and cut the engine block, the head unit, and the crank that go inside to make up the engine.
Now, you are a car worker working in America, and I think for most of us, we hear that and we think, oh, no, not a good year. But tell me, what kind of year are you having?
I'm having a great year. I mean, being a part of Hyundai is very exciting and stuff, and especially since we're doing so well in these rough times.
How secure do you feel?
I feel very secure. I don't feel threatened by any means. Hyundai takes care of their employees very much. And just, I mean, the sales numbers themselves speak for themselves.
Now, what do you think Hyundai has to teach, say, the GMs of the world?
I would say flexibility would probably be the biggest thing.
All right. Now, Rick, I know you're about to start your shift soon, so I'm going to thank you for joining us. Dan, I want to get back to you. It's sort of a relief to hear good news from the auto industry. What do you think American automakers can learn from what Hyundai's doing?
Oh, you know, here's the answer. Nothing, really. You know, Hyundai is prospering because Hyundai is a young company. It started without a lot of historical liabilities that GM, Ford, Chrysler, and indeed some Japanese car makers like Toyota is beginning to feel, you know, the first signs of decrepitude. You know, car companies are very dynamic, and they get old fast, and they build up, and they get arthritis quickly. You know, Hyundai is a younger company. They've had good management. They've had taken advantage of a time when computer-assisted design and a global supply chain have both combined to make those cars really good and really cheap. You know, it's a little bit like, you know, it is what it is to be an incumbent. You know, General Motors was the biggest car company in the world, and you get, it's all downhill from there. With Hyundai, they were a brash upstart, and they're going uphill.
All right, Dan, we've been talking about clunkers. I just have to ask, you as a living, you get to drive all these wonderful cars, but surely there was a clunker in your past you're sort of fond of.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, sure. But, you know, these cars have to be 25 years old or less. I mean, you know, I would never – my wife has a Jeep Cherokee Sport. You know, I just can't turn it in. I mean, it's worth postage.
Well, they did raise the rate of stamps. Okay, Dan, thanks so much. Dan Neal, Pulitzer Prize-winning automotive critic for the Los Angeles Times. We also talked to Mary Dubois in Oklahoma City. I almost said Automotive City. I like that.
Well, it is one.
There you go. Cash for Clunkers, one of the winners of the week here at The Takeaway.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual, dedicated to helping safeguard businesses and employees through comprehensive insurance products and services. More information at libertymutualgroup.com. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
I'm Farai Chidea here with Catherine Lanfer. We're in for John Hockenberry. And on The Takeaway, we've been following the evolution of a story on race relations this week. Last Thursday, arguably the most well-known African-American scholar, Henry Louis Gates Jr. of Harvard, was arrested for breaking into his own home in Cambridge, Massachusetts. The charges against him were dropped. Police said he was disorderly. President Obama then weighed in on Wednesday. He said that the Cambridge police, quote, acted stupidly. The Cambridge police commissioner on his end, Robert Haas, then defended his department.
My response is that this department is deeply pained and takes its professional pride seriously.
And last night, President Obama seemed to back off his original remark.
From what I can tell, the sergeant who was involved is an outstanding police officer. My suspicion is probably that it would have been better if cooler heads had prevailed.
Today we're hearing that the president has not retracted his criticism of this incident. However, there's another critique from Sergeant James L. Crowley, the arresting officer. He's holding a press conference at noon today. To find out how the story is playing out in Cambridge and Boston, Massachusetts, we've got Joe Shaka, the deputy managing editor of the Boston Herald, plus Boston-based TV and radio commentator, someone who I know well, Kelly Crossley.
Hi.
Good morning.
So, Joe, if you... Yeah, just sum up for us maybe what you're hearing from your readers. I'm sure that you're getting a lot.
We are. It's actually amazing. We yesterday had, I think, well over a million page views on the stories that we did. And the comment sections, of course, online have just been going crazy. And it really is interesting to watch because it's really emerged to sort of a public policy debate. It's hitting people on several levels, not just the race issue, which is an obvious one, but also how we deal with police and how the police deal with the public. And so people are recounting their experiences, both good and bad, what a police officer's job is, the role of authority. So there's been a very interesting debate.
Well, Callie, you have been, you know, visiting scholar at Harvard. You have worked on Eyes on the Prize, done all sorts of different things that track politics and race in America. Do you see Black Americans responding differently than non-Black Americans, particularly white Americans?
Well, and the chief way is that Joe is right. The policy question is one that has come up a lot in conversation. But from the Black perspective, it's, oh, my God, I have to once again remind my young son how to interact with a cop because he will not be Henry Louis Gates. And if it can happen to Henry Louis Gates, then it can happen to anybody. And that's the difference. All across America and certainly in Cambridge and Boston, there are white mothers who have never had to think about preparing a son to interact with a cop for an eventual or a confrontation, one that you would hope not happen, but that's very real. And that's the kind of conversation I'm hearing. The other thing is, my God, the man was in his house. And once you have produced your identification, what more does an African-American person have to do? Apparently there's a higher bar for us to achieve if we are to be given respect. So those are the threads that I'm hearing a lot in conversation among African-Americans. Americans in Cambridge and Boston.
You know, there's also some interesting conversation going on in the Black community, and you can see one piece of evidence for it and on Salon.com this morning with an anonymous essay that's posted there. But I've also heard this anecdotally from other African-American men, and that is, hey, he should have known what to do. Every Black man in America knows what to do when there's a cop, even if you are in your own home. And I'm wondering, Callie and Joe, if you've heard anything like that.
Well, I'll tell you, I think that one dangerous thing here, and in Boston, we're particularly aware of racial profiling. We remember, Callie certainly remembers back in 1989 where the Charles Stewart case made national headlines, the man who committed suicide later after having killed his wife, but told police that it was a Black man in a jogging suit who had committed the crime, leading police on a stop and search mission throughout Mission Hill small neighborhood in Boston, literally stopping every black man that fit that description. They were searching for a non-existent black man in a jogging suit. The neighborhood has never quite been the same since then. People felt their rights were violated, the police overstepped their bounds, and it's still fresh in the memory of a lot of people. But I do think that while racial profiling is clearly a fact, in this particular case, a lot of people are wondering, what if race was not the motivating factor for the arrest of Professor Gates? How does this officer then go on at some point after having been accused of being a racist, where racism is a very ugly thing to accuse someone of? How do you repair that damage?
Well, you know, Callie, you know, is this a question of race, class, or both? Because some people are also saying that, you know, Professor Gates, who is well known and who has sort of a mini empire at Harvard and online with theroot.com, has been a little entitled about this.
I've heard that quite a bit. For me, it starts with race, and I tell you why. Because the original call was two black men with backpacks attempting to burglarize a home. So, you know, this wasn't two men trying to enter a home. It was two black men with backpacks. If there wasn't a better stereotype about black men, I don't know what one could be. And so it began with race. Now, class obviously is involved here because a lot of people can't even get to the history that that President Obama articulated about the pattern and history of black men and Latino men being suspects, because all they see is this is a working class guy, the cop, and this is a guy who has everything else going for him. So why couldn't he just be more gracious about it and not have big lip about it, blah, blah, blah. And I'm at a loss to understand why they don't see that you begin with the context of someone like Skip Gates being questioned, being a suspect, really, for most of his life, off and on. I don't care how entitled he is. As a matter of fact, one of his colleagues, Lawrence Bobo, wrote an article, and the title was, "What Do You Call a Black Man with a Ph.D.?"
And we all know the N-word is the punchline of that sad joke. We're going to have to wrap it. Kelly Crossley, Boston-based TV and radio commentator, and Joe Shaka, deputy managing editor of the Boston Herald, talking about Henry Louis Gates, Jr., arrested for disorderly conduct. We have Femi with the headlines.
Thank you very much. Almost 29 minutes past the hour. The president is still talking health care, even though lawmakers now say that there's no way they can pass legislation on health care before they break up in August. He will meet with key senators in the Oval Office today. Senators in California, meanwhile, have just passed a budget to help close the state's $26 billion deficit. Yes, they did stay up all night there on the West Coast. Legislation, though, still has to pass the state assembly. And the federal minimum wage goes up 70 cents today to $7.25. That will change the minimum wage in 30 states. The others already have set theirs above the federal minimum. That's a quick look at headlines making news this morning.
Thank you so much, Femi. And we're going to be talking to Stephen Chu, Secretary of the Department of Energy.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable development in communities across the country. More at rockfound.org.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual, dedicated to celebrating personal responsibility and to proving its own with a comprehensive array of auto insurance products. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility, what's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway.
I'm Catherine Lanfer here in the studio with Farai Chidea.
Hey.
We are filling in for John Hockenberry. All right, Farai, if you want to know what Energy Secretary Stephen Chu is up to, you go to his Facebook page. More than 3,000 fans there keep up with things like his recent appearance on The Daily Show and his thoughts on which feedstock grasses can be the future of biofuel. But, yeah, those are his status updates. There's actually his mandate from President Obama to make climate change a priority for the world. The Nobel laureate in physics recently came back from a visit to China, where he talked to officials there about about greenhouse gases, but he came home to the clamor over health care reform. Now, when we talked to him earlier, I asked him, are you worried that this is going to detract from the climate change bill that's right now in the Senate? Democrats are short of those votes needed for its passage.
Well, I hope it's not going to get lost. I think both bills are incredibly important. And as the president has said, in the future, 10 years from now, 20 years from now, oil prices will be higher. In the future, we will be living in a carbon-constrained economy. It's become more and more apparent of the dangers of greenhouse gas emissions. And so we have an opportunity to say, okay, this is the way it's going to be 10 and 20 years from now. We can say that this is highly likely and position ourselves so that we can take advantage of what ultimately has to be a new industrial revolution to produce energy cleanly, to use it in the wisest way possible. Or we can try to pretend that this is 1950 and let other countries take the lead.
How much of a difference is this bill actually going to make?
I think at its core, the fact that it says we have to use our energy more efficiently, we have to start to say we have to limit our carbon emissions and we have to ratchet down the carbon emissions. Yes, there are allowances that will help U.S. and different regions transition, but in the end, we're going to have to do this. Just sending that signal both to the private sector, to industry, and to the average U.S. citizen actually will do a real remarkable amount, because once that signal is established, the scientists and engineers say, okay, we've got to do something about it. This is a long-term signal. Let's start thinking about it today.
You also, of course, are trying to send signals around the world. You were just in China. But there's a new Senate report that's talking about high-level meetings next week with both Chinese and American officials. And the Senate report says they better be talking about climate change. So I want to know, are we going to be seeing a Facebook status update that says you're sitting down with your counterparts from China again?
Yes. In fact, I will be. This meeting will be led by Secretary Clinton, Secretary Geithner, but I'll be participating in this meeting. This is a strategic and economic dialogue, and climate change is on the agenda. In my trip to China, every high-ranking official that I met talked about climate change, the devastating impacts it would have on China and the rest of the world if aggressive action weren't taken. So, and China is acting as aggressively in all the sectors, energy efficiency, clean energies, all these things. And in fact, they view this as an economic opportunity as well.
Now, there's a House bill on the environment that would put a tariff on countries that don't toe the line on greenhouse gases by 2020. How's that going to have an impact on your talks next week?
Well, I think that that's a much more difficult situation, and mostly what I want to do in my position as Secretary of Energy is to say to China and to develop ways that we can cooperate. What is not realized is the Department of Energy is in large part a research and development organization. We supply funds that allow people in universities, in national labs, in companies to develop new technologies. When I was in China, we signed an agreement that we were going to be cooperating on three areas in particular: building efficiency, transportation, more efficient vehicles, and electrification of vehicles, and finally, cooperating on how we can learn to use coal in a clean way, including the capture and storage of carbon dioxide.
Well, you know, I have to say, you know, the argument that you hear from both China and India is we are still growing. You've already hit prosperity. So don't try to shackle us when you're sitting in a position of prosperity. So how do you counter that argument?
Well, let me just talk about China.
Okay.
The issue is that, yes, they are still a developing country. Yes, the United States on a per capita basis is putting out more carbon, consuming more energy. So they say, well, we have differentiated responsibilities. But China is recognizing that we have to all be in this together. And this is the most important thing. China recognizes that if we go unabated, if we go as business as usual, the consequences of climate change to their people and to their country would be very bad. And so let's take a more positive attitude. Oh, by the way, this is an economic opportunity. We need a new industrial revolution. So energy becomes high technology. And you know, this is where we're great. We have the greatest R&D program in the world, and if the United States says this is where the new wealth creation will be, this is where we recapture high-quality, high-tech manufacturing, this is our future, and oh, by the way, it's also going to save the world.
Well, that's a great way to sell an idea. You know, one idea that isn't going over so well all the time is the cap and trade system that's being talked about in Congress right now. James Hansen, one of the first ones to, you know, alarm the world about climate change, has said that the cap and trade system being talked about in Congress right now is a sham. What do you think?
Well, I respect Jim a lot, but I have to say that It has some real advantages. There are some things that we have to be very careful about. I think in the trading part, it's very important that we have very open, transparent markets, that we work very hard so people can't manipulate them. But it does have some significant advantages. But mostly, it puts a cap on carbon, and it tells the United States and the world, we're going to ratchet down that cap. And so capturing carbon dioxide, is it harder? I'll admit it is harder, but I think the incentives are there, and I think we can do the same.
I would like your 90-second pitch on just how imminent the boiling point is with our climate.
It's 90 seconds, how imminent it is. The effects of what we have done today won't be felt for 100 years. It's very hard for the American public to understand this. If we continue to do what we're doing, many, many climate models are saying there's a 50-50 chance if we continue as business as usual that we will be 4 to 6 degrees warmer Celsius. That doesn't sound like much. Let me remind you, where we are today, where we were in the ice ages, it was only 5 to 6 degrees centigrade colder. Very, very different world. Canada, United States, down in Ohio, Pennsylvania, covered year-round in ice. A world 4 to 6 degrees centigrade warmer will also be a very, very different world.
Secretary Chu, I want to thank you for joining us today.
Thank you.
Stephen Chu is the Energy Secretary. You can link to his new Facebook page, YouTube channel, and Flickr by going to thetakeaway.org.
Well, coming up, the best films of summer that you haven't heard of. We check in with film critics A.O. Scott and Wesley Morris. Still ahead on The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Catherine Lanfer.
And I'm Farai Chidea. What happened in New Jersey yesterday sounds like the plot of a summer blockbuster or an episode of The Sopranos. A 10-year federal probe uncovered an international conspiracy involving money laundering, corruption of local and state governments, and the organ trade? Three mayors ended the day in handcuffs. Five rabbis are accused of funneling $3 million through religious nonprofit organizations, and a member of New Jersey's governor's administration has resigned. But my next guest says that's just business as usual in the Garden State of New Jersey. Joining us now is Bob Engel. He's the Trenton Bureau Chief for Gannett News Service and co-author of the book The Soprano State, New Jersey's Culture of Corruption. So, Bob, give us the framework of what's actually going on here.
Well, we call the book The Soprano State because we maintain that the government treats people like the mob treats people. And the culture of corruption part of it is trying to explain that situation that we get from California and all the other states when they read the book.
What about this case with the, you know, how do rabbis get involved in this case?
Well, this particular one goes back to one particular fellow who was caught for bank fraud. And apparently he's the one who spilled the beans on everybody else. I don't know why this particular group decided to do something that's allegedly did something that's illegal. I don't know how that came into it. But the person who turned on everybody else is pretty much thought to be a fellow who was trying to pass big checks that were not backed by money.
Okay, kidneys. How did what's the deal with the kidneys in this case?
That's weird, even for New Jersey. And I think that the main person behind that is actually a New Yorker. I think he's from Brooklyn or somewhere. That surprised. That was the only thing.
Trafficking
in
kidneys.
That surprised me.
I think $160,000 was the price put on one of them. So, you know, is it accurate to say that New Jersey is a place where corruption runs rampant? Because, you know, for example, even some of the state officials say that, you know, that the state is, you know, acting U.S. attorney said pervasive nature of public corruption in the state is responsible.
I think it is the most corrupt state in the nation, and I think we proved that in the Sopranos state, the book. There is something in this state that allows it to happen, whereas in other states, people wouldn't put up with it.
Well, you know, it's kind of it's got to feel good in a weird way to get all this attention. You know, I mean, is that an upside? Like, ooh, our state, the most corrupt state. Is that exciting?
Well, I really don't think there's a lot of pride in that. I think there is a lot of pride in having the TV show based here.
And Real Housewives of New Jersey.
Yeah, right. Or having any show based here. I think people have a certain pride in that. But I don't think having your public officials arrested again and again, because in a way that does reflect on the public and the voters.
Well, thanks. We have been speaking with Bob Engel, Trenton Bureau Chief for Gannett News Service, co-author of the book The Soprano State, New Jersey's Culture of Corruption.
Don't you think there are a lot of contenders for most corrupt state? I mean, come on.
Some people here say Rhode Island. I don't want to besmirch that lovely small state.
All right.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, examining whether states have the right to legislate the foods and restaurants that people choose. Is it a responsible way to make communities healthier, or does it violate freedom of choice? Viewpoints now at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
I'm Farai Chidea, here with Catherine Lanfer, and we're sitting in for John Hockenberry. We are about to talk about some very special movies that maybe will elevate your IQ or something like that. But first, we have Femi Okeh with the headlines.
Thank you very much. 12 minutes to the top of the hour. Top Senate Democrat Harry Reid says there will be no vote on health care before the August recess. That means the Senate misses President Obama's deadline, and Reid says he doesn't want a rushed bill.
It's better to have a product that is one that's based on quality and thoughtfulness rather than trying to jam something through.
The president says that he's fine with the delay as long as it doesn't drag out. He says he wants to sign health care changes into law by the end of the year. California is now around about halfway to closing its $26 billion budget gap. The state Senate just passed the budget deal. I know, it's not even 7 a.m. yet in California. So they're working all night. But lawmakers are still up after working all the way through the night. The budget package now must now pass through the lower house before Governor Schwarzenegger can sign it into law. And the lower house is debating it now. The police officer who arrested Harvard scholar Henry Louis Gates is speaking out. Sergeant James Crowley tells WZAM radio that the president is, I'm going to quote him here, way off base, end of quote. He was commenting on the situation without all of the facts. That's according to the sergeant. Other officers are now defending Crowley. Colleagues, both black and white, say that he's not a racist or rogue cop. Being commander-in-chief has made President Obama more spiritual. That's the admission the president made to Terry Moran on yesterday's Nightline program.
I had a habit of praying every night before I go to bed. I pray all the time now because I've got a lot of stuff on my plate.
On the president's plate this morning, he'll be meeting with the Senate Majority Leader, Democratic Majority Leader Harry Reid, and Senator Max Baucus to discuss health care. He'll also be tackling education, meeting up with Secretary of State Clinton, Vice President Biden. I think it's going to be a prayer-filled day. That's a look at your news for
yeah,
now.
Yeah, sounds like no doubt. Thanks, Femi.
You're welcome.
And it is Friday. Woohoo! And it's time to talk movies here on The Takeaway. We have covered the blockbusters like Harry Potter on the show, but what about foreign films? Two of our favorite critics are here to tell us what's worth checking out this weekend if you have had your fill of popcorn movies. We've got A.O. Scott in the studio, film critic for our partner, The New York Times, and Wesley Morris, film critic for The Boston Globe, joins us from the studios of our partner, WGBH in Boston. So, A.O. Scott, I'm going to talk to you first. People have seen these blockbuster films, but you have some more quirky, darker, stranger films teed up. Let's start with this irreverent British political satire. In the Loop, what is it? Why is it getting so much attention?
In the Loop is a British political satire. It takes place in a kind of it's a familiar sort of topical conceit. The Britain and the United States are about to go to war with an unnamed Middle Eastern country.
Oh, hang on a minute. What does that remind me of? Let me think.
And it's about, I mean, it's less about war than about the kind of the internal workings, the sort of the ugly, grubby reality of politics. And it suggests that the ship of state is powered by vanity, stupidity, opportunism, hypocrisy, duplicity, more or less in that order. And so it's a lot of fun.
So is it like masterpiece theater? Do we hear beautiful accents?
No.
Well...
Well, Wesley, you are laughing here. You've seen it, I gather.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I think it's really smart. It's very funny. It reminded me of a very modern version of one of those giant costume dramas where, I mean, not the Masterpiece Theater sort, but like where there's just a lot of stuff happening. There's a lot of people talking.
Yeah.
And usually it's in preparation of some sort of royal event or, you know, the retinue of a certain kind of dueling retinue between two camps.
It's a court drama. It's like almost like a Renaissance court drama, but with a lot of obscenity.
I mean,
let's get to the obscenity because that's what we like early in the morning.
Now, all the stuff you can't say on the radio.
Exactly. Well, you know, people have said, you know, Rahm Emanuel, one of President Obama's right-hand men or right henchmen, depending on how you criticize it. Rahm Emanuel uses a lot of swear words, and this movie, In the Loop, has two British bureaucrats going at it with a lot of bombs.
Why wasn't I told about this?
Why the f*** would I tell you about it? I've told you to f*** off twice and yet you're still here.
You should tell me about it because it's a scheduled media appearance by this department's Secretary of State, so therefore it falls well within my purview.
Within your purview?
Yes.
Where do you think you are? In some f***ing Regency costume drama? This is a government department, not a f***ing Jane f***ing Austen novel.
Yeah, so those bombs I was talking about, those were F-bombs, just to be clear. So
compared to this character, who's loosely based on Tony Blair's actual press secretary, Alistair Campbell. This guy's name is Malcolm Tucker. I think he makes Rahm Emanuel look like the church lady. I mean, this is some...
Yeah,
some heavy.
He actually looks a little bit. Peter Capaldi, the actor who plays him, looks like Rahm Emanuel too. A little. I mean, you know, the ashen hair, the wiry physique.
If Rahm Emanuel had lived on nothing but heroin, scotch, and cigarettes for the last 15 years,
and how's
we don't know
James?
He has it.
James Gandolfini is in this too, right?
Yes, James Gandolfini.
Is he good?
Yeah, he is. He's doing this thing these days of playing kind of against Tony Soprano type of. He did it in Pelham 1-2-3 also, playing kind of sensitive, slightly fussy, neurotic characters. He plays a Pentagon general who's trying to stop the rush to war.
All right, gentlemen, enough with the Brits. My idea of a good August is a Slurpee, air conditioning, and subtitles.
Ooh.
What have we got, huh?
I'll give you my phone number after.
Yeah. Only if you're buying the Slurpees, dude. So what are the foreign films that are breaking out this weekend?
I guess Wesley will go with you.
In New York, anyway, I know there's A Woman in Berlin that opened recently, and Lorna Silence, which is a Dardenne Brothers movie that I'm not sure if it's opened yet.
I think next week.
But it's coming.
Now, Woman in Berlin, is that based on the book that came out not long ago, which was the journal of a woman who was in Berlin when the Russians came in and did their occupation?
Yes.
So in other words, it's not going to be an Anne Hathaway remake in 5 years, right? It's not
you know
going
what?
To be
it
light
be.
And happy. Oh, stop it.
I don't Let's put give anything people... past anybody.
Okay, give me the 10-second synopsis. What kind of movies, what kind of experience is this going to be while you and I are having our Slurpees?
I mean, it's not going to be pleasant. I mean, it's a very powerful movie. It's really well made. It's well acted. But, I mean, the upside of this movie, I think, I don't know how Tony feels, I think that one of the strong things about this movie is that it doesn't do any of the sort of sentimentalizing or sensationalizing of what is essentially a difficult story. I mean, you've got these people who used to work for the Third Reich, and they're sort of fighting. I mean, some of them did. I mean, some of them were just ordinary German citizens. Now sort of dealing with this brutal occupation that lasted for about 8 weeks from the Russians. And, you know, it's not a good summer for the Russians at the movies anyway.
Oh, yeah. I just want to reintroduce you. I mean, Wesley Morris, you are from the Boston Globe. We also have A.O. Scott from the New York Times. And, you know, I just want to get to this other movie. You have Lorna in Silence. I'll start with you. What, you know, Tony, A.O., I know you have many names.
Well, Lorna Silence is from Jean-Pierre and Luc Dardenne, who are Belgian brothers, who are two of the, I think, you know, two of the really great filmmakers working today that nobody on this side of the ocean seems to have heard of. And this is, I mean, they make very intense, very austere dramas, mostly about kind of working class or marginalized people in Belgium. This is about Lorna in the title is an Albanian immigrant living in Belgium. And these movies are very, they're very spare. They can be a little harsh, but there's something very beautiful and even poetic about them. I mean, the stories are almost like fables of modern life at the same time that they're very realistic. And they're great performances and are really, I mean, this is not a feel-good movie, but some of us like to go in and feel bad while we're enjoying our Slurpees.
Oh, hey, I think that's a takeaway right there, and I want to thank both of you, A.O. Scott of our partner, the New York Times, and another one of our partners is WGBH. That's where Wesley Morris of the Boston Globe joins us from. Catherine?
You know, we've been looking at the winners and the losers of the week this morning. President Obama selling his embattled health care plan, White Sox pitcher Mark Burley throwing a perfect game, and some old cars that owners are trading in for cash. You could think of the Cash for Clunkers program as one of the week's winners. Here is the take of Dan Neal, automotive critic for the LA Times.
One of the problems of making cars that last 20 years is that cars last 20 years, and the rollover rate is so slow. So those 2002 Cadillac Escalades that people were driving around, they're still driving around. They'll still be driving around a decade from now, but for programs like this.
All right. We'd love to know what you thought were the winners and the losers of the week. You can tell us at 1-877-8-MY-TAKE.
I'm Farai Chidea.
I'm Catherine Lanford. The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. The Rockefeller Foundation and its campaign for American workers. More at rockfound.org. And by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is The Takeaway.
You know, you can catch the show live Monday through Friday. Thanks for listening. If you have any feedback or think there's any stories we should be covering on The Takeaway, contact us at 1-877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org. See ya.